afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's November 4th, 2006, just 3 days before the fateful elections coming up. I'm Harley Schlanger. I'll be your host today. And this is indeed a crucial moment in history. We're going into this Tuesday's midterm elections. There are incredible stakes. The House and the Senate are both up for grabs. The Democratic Party could take the House and the Senate, which would enhance the lame duck status of Bush and Cheney. In fact, it could take away any power they have. Now, beyond Tuesday, though, whatever happens on Tuesday, and we're not going to make a prediction on this because while the Democrats could have a landslide victory, they haven't done what they should have done. But beyond Tuesday, we then have the real battle, which starts November 8th. In which on the one side, the war party, the grouping behind the disastrous Iraq war, the catastrophe in Afghanistan, the same group of people behind Dick Cheney, including his wife Lynn Cheney, which wants a war with Iran, with Sudan, possibly even with Russia and China, and the same group that's behind the deindustrialization of this country. They are preparing for the next round of wars, even if they lose. And so the question of what happens in this election is critical from the standpoint of war and peace and Renaissance versus Dark Age. Now, the problem is that we don't just have the George Shultz-Lynn Cheney faction in the Republican Party, who can legitimately be called fascists. But we have a similar force inside the Democratic Party, which has a left and right wing to it. The George Soros networks, the so-called radical leftists in the Democratic Party, and the Felix Rowetton, free trade Democratic Leadership Council types, both of whom are out to sabotage the election. So you have this left-right operation in the Democratic Party. You have the Shultz-Lynn Cheney fascist side of the Republican Party. And both of these groups are on the wrong side of the fight that was outlined by Lyndon LaRouche in his October 31st webcast. He defined the battle as that between those who support the sovereign nation state, the idea of the constitutional republic of the United States, against those who are supporters of a new global fascist empire, which goes by the name globalization. Now, we're going to be talking with four young people today who are on the front lines of this fight. Lyndon LaRouche said his strategy for the midterm elections is to mobilize youth on the campuses to crack the Gestapo that was set up by Lynn Cheney through individuals such as David Horowitz, the Ayn Rand Institute, Daniel Pipes, the neocon network in general that's spying on professors and trying to silence opposition on the campuses. LaRouche said we're going to deploy onto these campuses to activate young people, not just for the vote, although voting is important, but to recruit the next generation of leadership. Now, I just want to identify an aspect of the revolt that is going on in the country that's absolutely fascinating if it weren't so urgent that it succeed, and that is a revolt within the military. We have what Jeff Steinberg characterized in a series of articles in the EIR as the General's Revolt, the large numbers of officers from the U.S. military who have come out against Rumsfeld and against the conduct of the war by the Bush-Cheney administration. But this is going to go even further on Monday when the Army Times, the Navy Times, the Air Force Times, and the Marine Times, the newspapers that go out to every base in the world where there are American military personnel, these newspapers are going to have an editorial which is going to call for facing the hard, bruising truth, Donald Rumsfeld must go. So there's a revolt in the military. And by the way, when asked, is this time for the election, they said, no, it's timed because George W. Bush said he's going to keep Rumsfeld and Cheney till the end of his term. And for the military people, that's too long. They have to go now, and they might as well take Bush with them. As LaRouche said, he wants a double impeachment come the sitting of the new Congress. So the question is, will there be a revolt of the voters? Will there be a revolt of the American people? And will it just be an anarchistic revulsion, a one-time vote, and then disappearing back into the foxholes? Or is there a new leadership that will emerge in the Democratic Party around the ideas of a scientific and technological and cultural renaissance that Lyndon LaRouche discussed in his webcast this week? And to determine that, to make sure that's what happens, the LaRouche Youth Movement is hitting the campuses. It's hitting the campaign trail. We're going to hear first from the keystone, the key battleground state of Missouri. Then we're going to hear from Connecticut, where we have a very active group that was called in the Hartford Courant, the leading paper in the state of Connecticut, the Harmonious Hecklers, singing hecklers, who are singing a song about Joe Lieberman's great love for Dick Cheney and William F. Buckley. So we'll hear from Miles Robinson, who's been in the middle of that. We'll also hear from Los Angeles, from Nick Walsh, who's been in the middle of a fight out here against the fascist shock troops of the Ayn Rand Institute and David Horowitz. And then from the coordinating center of the LaRouche Youth Movement, we have Nico Paulson, who's on the phone with us from Leesburg. So let me start with someone who only has a few minutes because she's got to go back out into the fight. Ardina Clark, who's with a hardy team of LaRouche organizers from all over the country, who settled in St. Louis just a little more than a week ago and have already created, or maybe it's 2 weeks ago, have already created an enormous stir. Ardina, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Why don't you give our listeners a report on what you guys have been doing and the responses you've been getting from the students in the state of Missouri?
Okay, well, like you mentioned, we've only been here for just shy of 2 weeks, and so we don't have a lot of time. But what our initial strategy was to come to all of the major campuses in the area and announce our presence by doing early morning deployments and blitzing as much of the campus as we possibly could, emphasizing on the economics department and on the political science departments, and writing special notes that read such things as, don't get caught with Lynn Cheney's dick stuck in your mouth on all the whiteboards, to kind of, you know, announce that we're here.
You'll be happy to know Fletcher didn't bleep that, Ardina.
All right, awesome. So immediately that causes a certain kind of stir to take place there. So what happens from there is we've just been hitting, in particular, a couple of campuses we've been focusing on, UMSL, University of Missouri, St. Louis, Mizzou, the University of Missouri, Columbia, Florissant Valley Community College. There are others, but these are the ones that we've been able to have the biggest impact on so far. What I mean by that is the first webcast that we had, it was at this Florissant Valley Community College. We had literally maybe a day or so to organize it, to organize for it on the campuses. And what happened was that we got the coordinator of the Young Democrats on campus to sponsor a room for us. And within that brief period of time, they were so happy to have the political activity and the excitement, since it is a very close election, that they organized a teacher to bring her entire classroom for that period to watch the entirety of Lyndon LaRouche's webcast, in addition to the other contacts that we brought there. And they keep inviting us back. So that's kind of what we've got on the Democratic side of things, because everybody really realizes that it's a crucial time of history that we're in and the significance of this election.
Now, let me something just mention, on the Missouri election, the issue, this is one of the three Senate races which may determine the outcome. And there's a Republican neocon named Jim Talent, who should be retired back to Missouri. And by activating voters on the campuses, we're hoping to provide an extra margin. But you had an interesting encounter with a group of Republicans, didn't you?
Yes, on a different university, on the University of Missouri, St. Louis, where we did the same thing as far as strategy goes. So we had a couple of Republicans come up to the table and kind of have a discussion with us. Later on, they saw us organizing in a different area of the campus, and they told us that they were on their way to go to the Young Republicans meeting. So they said it would be great if you guys came and we discussed these things. So we did. We went, and we had a brawl for about 2 hours. And the main person that was kind of, you know, counter arguing against us as we were kind of talking to them was a person who's actually running for Congress here. His name is, Dave Bertelsen. Dave Bertelsen is running for Congress. He's a Republican running for Congress. And so we had a ball. I mean, one thing that kind of characterizes a little bit of a different kind of reaction from the Republicans here is that while they are not, you know, exactly critical of the Bush-Cheney administration, they do acknowledge that there are definite problems with the way this war on terror is being run, and are even willing to discuss the economic considerations that might be responsible for what we've got with this kind of quote-unquote terror situation. So that's something that I found that's unique to Missouri since we've been here. Not a lot of Republicans in other places are willing to just, you know, kind of say, yeah, I kind of intellectually understand that there are different elements besides just war on terror, kill these, you know, people, war on terror, you know, kind of vibe that you get from people.
Now, Ardina, you had the Democrats then at the community college. You had the Republicans at University of Missouri, St. Louis. And who largely showed up at the University of Missouri event?
Oh, yeah. A group of Marxists showed up to the University of Missouri, Columbia. You're talking about Columbia?
Yeah, yeah.
The Mizzou? Yeah. There was a whole reading group of the young Marxists that came to debate with us. We had a big turnout there, too. There were about 13 contacts that came, again, in just a period of a day's worth of organizing or so. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. And they know LaRouche also. And a couple of them actually are coming tonight from that campus. Two of them are driving 2 hours to come and do some reading with us and to work on LaRouche's paper, The Vernadsky and Dirichlet Principle. And they're meeting up with some other contacts that are from the local area here in St. Louis. We're doing that tonight at 8.
Now, Ardina, just because I know you've got to get back out there, but you are an elected member of the Los Angeles County Democratic Central Committee, and you've been in Missouri now for 10 or so days. How can you characterize what you've seen? Is there a change in the thinking among youth because of our presence there? How would you just characterize it?
Yeah, I have a perfect characterization. The way we went about getting all of the room secured was by going to, you know, the leadership on campus, the presidents of the Young Democrats, the presidents of, you know, just various campus organizations. And what happens initially is they try to give you the runaround and tell you how much money you're going to have to pay and kind of shirk you off because nobody wants to take up the responsibility of organizing for an event. But the moment you say, wait a minute, no, we're not, you know, just some young Democrats that are kind of campaigning part-time. We're with the LaRouche Youth Movement. We're building a movement. We're serious about impeaching Cheney and Bush, and we want to have a real serious dialogue with real leaders on your campus. Where are those people? At the moment that happens, it's a different discussion. The doors are open. They say, hey, you know, I'm so glad you guys are here. We've been busting our, you know, butts trying to get a real serious discussion and fight around this time in history that we're in. What can we do for you? And that's been the response across the board, regardless of whether or not they're Republicans or Democrats. So that's really one thing that's really amazing.
And do you have any sense of what might happen with the election? Apparently there have been a lot of absentee voters. There's a high interest in the Senate race. All the pollsters, of course, are saying it's neck and neck. What do you think will happen on Tuesday? Any ideas?
Well, let's put it this way. Those Republicans that we were talking to the other day at the Young Republicans meeting, they gave us numbers to go and turn out the Democratic vote because they wouldn't mind an impeachment of Cheney and Bush at all, even though they're Republicans. So I think we've got this one.
All right. Well, so you're experiencing firsthand the rejection that's going on in the military. By the way, today there's a report out on the next month's issue of Vanity Fair magazine, and even such sleazy characters as Richard Pearl and Kenneth Adelman are coming out saying, gee, if they knew the war would have turned out this way, they wouldn't have supported it. They say Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld blew it. So you saw some of that firsthand, that distancing from the current administration.
Yes, very much so.
All right, Ardina, well, is there anything else you'd like to add in closing?
No, that's good.
All right. So, Ardina, thank you for joining us, and go out and with your other colleagues out there, stir the place up the next couple of days.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, Harley.
Goodbye. Now we have Nick Walsh, who's here in the our so-called studio in Los Angeles. Nick has had a very busy week and a half because he's become one of the catalyzing figures of a revolt at UCLA against a specifically degenerate brand of the neocons, and at the same time has been brought in on discussions on the UCLA radio station. Nick, how would you characterize this last week on the campuses?
It's been a there's been a pretty huge change. The last time I was on the show, I think it was a couple weeks ago, I believe. Yeah, 2 weekends ago. We had just finished the first week of the Goebbels pamphlet distribution, and we were talking about how we'd have to see in the coming week or two exactly what the full effect of this thing was going to be, because it's just beginning to kind of stir things. And we've seen it in the past 2 weeks, especially this past week. I mean, in years of organizing that, we've never been covered in the newspaper of the school. We've never been on their radio program, and we've never been able to really engage the student groups, more due to the apathy and the problems of the student body rather than the way we were organizing. I think we've always done things the right way. But now in the last, just this last week, some of the interventions we did against the Ayn Rand Institute, which involved drama and music, and that, and then the chorus that we've been, the different choruses we've had, we had very good coverage about what we've been doing in the Daily Bruin newspaper. We also had front page coverage in the USC Daily Trojan newspaper. And then I was also invited on about an hour-long interview on the UCLA radio, all within the last week or so. Just a very singular change.
All right, let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is the show for Saturday, November 4th. If you haven't voted early, make sure you go out and vote. We need to get a landslide against the Bush-Cheney administration. And if you have a question for our panel, you can send it to us today via email at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. We're talking with Nick Walsh, who's one of the early members of the LaRouche Youth Movement from Los Angeles, and Nick's telling us about the organizing there. So, Nick, have you found people who have read the pamphlet since it's been out and around for about 2 weeks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most people, UCLA has, we've been concentrating there, but then we've also hit USC, we've hit Pasadena City College, and a few others. We've also heavily saturated University of California, San Diego, with probably as heavily as UCLA and then San Diego have been the two places we've targeted. And in these places, there has been a tremendous response that I don't think we've really ever had before. And it's just really fun what's going on right now. People, we're hitting a sweet spot with these discussion that LaRouche is leading about the campus Gestapos, the need to get the November 7th Democratic landslide to occur, why students are apathetic based on these Gestapo operations being run by Horowitz, by Yaron Brook of the ARI, by Daniel
Pipes,
and others.
Just to review, since there may be some people who didn't hear a previous show, a major focus on UCLA was an October 16th address by Yaron Brook, who's the head of the Ayn Rand Institute, in which he called for killing hundreds of thousands of Muslims. Now, what's been the response at UCLA when students hear that on their campus you had this psychopath call for the mass murder of people in Middle Eastern nations?
Mm-hmm. Well, at first there was really none. There wasn't one. I don't think there was going to be one until we intervened. We contacted the newspaper. We contacted the Muslim Student Association and other student groups, the African-American student groups. And we also made this a subject of public discussion. For example, one of Yaron Brook's cronies came and spoke Thursday following when Brook had spoken, I think a couple days later. And And we made a major intervention at that thing where we had someone dress up as Ayn Rand. We had someone dress up as Greenspan. Ayn Rand was throwing condoms around. You know, it was just a sexual joke telling people, protect yourself from terrorism with these. We were singing. And we got into a heated exchange with UCLA students who were not Ayn Rand supporters. They were just there to kind of listen to the thing. There were about 60 people in the audience, and we got into a heated debate with about 5 to 10 of the students at any given time about why we were doing this, why we were interrupting, and what the real nature of the ARI was. A Daily Bruin reporter was there, as were these radio kids, and they covered it fully and did a very honest, very fair coverage of why we were intervening and covered it. It was a very good article on our behalf. And then they invited me into the radio program where we discussed this for about an hour. Already, and then at USC, as I said, you had a similar response where we intervened the next night and the same guy at USC. And the newspaper decided to call into our office a couple days later and make sure they got quotes from our organizers, and they ran a front-page story documenting how we had intervened on this genocidal cult called the Ayn Rand Institute at USC. So there seems to me to be an intention, now that we've started something, people with responsibility, like students who write articles in the paper, do want this to be known about. There has been a response where people are saying in a certain way, this is important that students are aware that this is going on.
And we can take it a step further, because CNN, in the person of Wolf Blitzer, did what you might call a blitz against Lynn Cheney herself, the Dragon Lady herself, who is one of the founders of Campus Watch. And Blitzer asked her, as she and other Republicans were making a lot of noise about how Democratic Senate candidate in Virginia, Webb, had written some racy passages in novels he wrote 10, 15 years ago, one in 2000. And Blitzer asked Lynn Cheney about her book, Sisters, which until recently no one had heard about, a steamy lesbian novel set in the western states of the United States. And here was this hypocritical Lynn Cheney. And by the way, these Republicans and the radical right ministers should be very careful given the Foley case and the most recent one, where they're all looking a little haggard, you might say. But in the case of Lynn Cheney, she was hit right between the eyes by Wolf Blitzer. So clearly the work that we're doing nationally is having an impact from top to bottom. Now, you also had an encounter a couple nights ago with one of the leading windbags of this Campus Watch Gestapo, David Horowitz. What happened there?
Well, this is a really wild event. It's just another continuing element of our intervention against this whole operation, as you're saying. He's an essential just tool of this whole movement. So a few of us went. It was because it was more of a private event, so we couldn't deploy an entire chorus like we like to. So a couple of us snuck in. And we had a leaflet prepared with a picture of Lynn Cheney with David Horowitz bent over her knee, spanking him, and with a paddle.
That's the PG version of the poster. Go ahead, Nick.
Horowitz was saying, don't tell Papa Dick I was a bad commie. And so it was pretty funny. And Adrian Yule came storming in with these leaflets in the middle, just a couple minutes into the speech. And I have to say, these people in this audience were the sickest people I've ever talked with, because we were pretending to be members of Horowitz's group at San Diego campus at first. And so we were talking to the people about, we were kind of prodding them, we got to deal with these left professors, it's so terrible. And these people were all, like, just ideologically driven to destroy and attack and get rid of this dissent on the campuses against the war coming from the professors. And I do admit, it was the craziest thing, it was the craziest kind of cultural environment I've ever been in. It was a true fascist kind of cultural, discussion. This is in the wine and cheese part before he even started speaking. This is his supporters. These are all boomers, white, rich boomers. So anyway, Adrian comes in during a couple of minutes into his speech. He says, Mr. Horowitz, they're handing out this leaflet about you outside. And they grab him right away and drag him out, but he drops one of the leaflets, and people kind of pass it around and were gasping a bit. And then Celaya, a couple of minutes later, just casually walked up to him at the podium, and I said, David, you are a shameful, shameful little man. And I was looking right in his eye, and he looked quite frightened and quite intimidated. Because that's really what he is. He's just a very phony person. He's just a total phony guy who's just sold himself to the money to, you know, work for these individuals. And there was a heavily physical retaliation against me, you know, involving about seven guys, some of them being audience members, you know, to drag me out, which was quite, it was definitely what you'd call assault. So if anybody has any doubts about how David Horowitz and his group feels about, you know, students' ability to have academic freedom, I think it was expressed pretty clearly there. My friend then continued to denounce him and expose his connections to Yaron Brook and the campus Gestapo. He was equally physically assaulted and dragged out also by this crowd. So that's how they respond to dissent.
That's how they debate.
It was. I think we definitely got under their skin, to say the least.
Well, Nick, I think we're under their skin all over the country. We have another couple minutes before our break. Is there anything else you want to add on the campaign?
Well, yeah, one more thing on this note of how people have been changing, because it's difficult. A lot of the Muslim student groups have very good intentions, and they tend to be very scared. They tend to be very nervous and since 9/11.
Well, they've heard of Guantanamo and rendition and waterboarding, which Cheney says is a no-brainer, so it's not surprising.
It's not surprising. It's almost understandable. But then again, if they don't fight, that is where we're headed. But we, so just a quick example of a certain type of change, because at the UCLA, when this ARI individual was there, the Muslim students decided they were not going to do anything, even though they knew that these guys were pushing genocide against Muslims. They said, well, we'll just, it's a little event, not many people go, we'll just ignore it. Now, when we went and intervened, as I said, it was covered in the radio and in the newspaper, the students, the Muslim group at University of California, Irvine, read the coverage of it in the Daily Bruin, and were very interested in what we did. And they have Yaron Brook coming to speak at Irvine Monday night. And we've been in a, they were planning initially to just do the same thing as the UCLA Muslim students had done, just to ignore it. Now they're considering intervening. And they've been provoked. They've at least been in a discussion with us about maybe how we could intervene, what kind of things we should do, what kind of protests we should have. To me, that's a very interesting kind of sign of a type of organizing, a successful organizing that we're beginning to generate on the campuses that has very unpredictable potential. You know, this thing could really break out, you know, in many different ways.
Well, Nick, thanks for joining us. I know you've got to run off for a previous appointment, but I think the point you're making is an extremely good one. As Lyndon LaRouche said when he initiated the campaign with the pamphlet, we've got to free the youth from the fear of challenging authority, especially when the authority are a bunch of sophist criminals, such as the Bush-Cheney administration. So, Nick, thanks for joining us, and we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with Nico and Miles in just a moment. So you're listening to The LaRouche Show, which is live every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. You can pick it up on the LaRouchePub.com website, and we also have all the previous shows archived. So if you're listening now and you want to get your friends to listen to hear what you're hearing about, how we're breaking open the campuses from under the control of the Lynn Cheney, John Train Gestapo, tell them to go on to the LaRouche Pub website, look on the left-hand side under the LaRouche Show, click on there, and three of the last four programs we've had have been on the incredible breakthroughs that have taken place on the campuses. You can get a copy of the pamphlet on the John Train, Lynn Cheney Gestapo on the campus. It's available by calling us at 800-929-7566. If you're a student, call and order three or four bundles. We'll send them to you. You can liberate your campus from this kind of fascist tyranny. 800-929-7566. That's the LaRouche PAC number. You can also volunteer to organize. You can make a contribution if you want. But give us a call, and we'll send out that pamphlet to you, 929-7566, and we'll clean the campuses up so there can be some real discussion there. So we're back live on the LaRouche Show. It's November 4th, 2006, just a couple of days before the midterm elections, which may go a long way to determining whether Bush and Cheney are going to be able to launch a nuclear strike against Iran, send troops into Somalia, blow up North Korea. All of these things are in play, and the Bush administration continues to say they are defending this war. He's going to defend it to the very end. He's going to stay the course, although now he's not sure what that means. Now, another one who's part of the stay the course faction is whiny Joe Lieberman, the senator who claims to be a Democrat from Connecticut. And we have with us on the show right now Miles Robinson. Miles, you, I understand, have had a few sightings of whiny Joe recently.
Yeah. We've had a squad here in Connecticut from the Boston Limb now for, like, off and on about two solid weeks. So we've been running into whiny Joe quite a bit. And just for a little background, I mean, I don't know if people have really been following this, but Joe is not running as a Democrat this year, even though he is the incumbent Democratic senator from this state.
He lost the nomination.
Yeah, right. He lost the nomination in August. So he ran as an independent. He created his own political party. And that's what the race is. The Republican candidate is somewhat of a non-entity. And he's running against this guy, Ned Lamont. And so what we're doing is we're going around really trying to make sure that the population realizes exactly what Joe Lieberman represents. And the funny thing is, too, is that we have this major flank right now, as Ardina and Nick outlined, around going to the campuses and mobilizing the youth vote. And the funny thing is that Joe Lieberman, as much as this guy wants to pass himself off as some liberal, left-wing Democrat, he has been a stay-the-course neocon now since the beginning of this war. And this is essentially his main campaign flank, saying that Ned Lamont is going to be soft on terror, and that if you vote for Ned Lamont, you know, you're going to open the country up for a terror attack, et cetera. I mean, it's the same kind of Rove-style fear tactic that you're getting from the majority of the Republican Party right now. And Lieberman is running around also pulling this really pathetic pity card that the Democrats have ousted him from the party and that this is a blatant attack against his equal bipartisanship, which he uniquely represents in the Democratic Party. And, you know, he's real slime. I mean, he's a guy who can actually make you sympathize with him. And what he's trying to do to the population is incredibly evil, and is within the same realm as Bush and Cheney pushing for an extension of this war with Iran. It's the same intention.
Well, Miles, let's just let the listeners know a little bit more about him, because here's a man who claims to be a solid Democrat, but we went back into it, look at his first election, and who did we find behind this paragon of Democratic virtue?
Mr. Buckley.
Bill Buckley. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, William F. Buckley was the founder of something called BuckPack, which was his political action committee, and this was funding the attack ads against Lieberman's incumbent opponent back in 1988. And Lieberman was fully endorsed by Bill Buckley then, as he is today, openly. And he essentially has been a major element in this neocon apparatus for perpetual war. And, you know, the proof of this is in what this guy is actually promoting, and also where his money is coming from. So to have a little fun with this, we have a wig of Mr. Buckley, and we printed out some Buckley bucks, which are some bright green dollar bills with Joe Lieberman and Bill Buckley embracing each other on the front. And on the back, it's got a little blurb excerpted from one of the EIR articles about the relationship and the link historically and ideologically and also financially between William F. Buckley and Joseph Lieberman. And so the sightings that we have had of Joe Lieberman have been very, very fun.
But Miles, before we get to that, I just want to bring up the other side. It's Buckley, but there's another very prominent Republican who we've identified as one of Lieberman's key supporters, the vice president.
I believe that her wig we also have. We've been dressing up as well as Lynn Cheney, who's the co-founder of ACTA, the American Council for Trustees and Alumni, with Joe Lieberman.
So Lieberman is totally embedded in these networks.
Yeah, he's not some sideline spectator. I mean, he's integral in this plot, partly because he's ostensibly a Democrat, so he's got a lot of say in swaying the opposition to these policies.
If you want to make the listeners ill, just imagine a menage a trois with Lynn and Dick Cheney and whiny Joe in the middle. So what happened at Mike's bar the other night?
Well, Joe decided he wasn't going to show up for a debate. And there was really no reason for this, even though that we completely made a mockery out of the last televised live debate in front of a live audience in Connecticut. We had a trio singing, and then another duet stood up. So this guy was interrupted twice by our songs, which were very polemical against Lynn Cheney and Joe Lieberman. But to avoid this, which was this one the other night, was going to be in a rather sterile environment in a television studio, he, I guess, thought that he could buttonhole the rich political people in Hartford at Mayor Mike's bar, this ex-lush who used to be a mayor and now owns a bar. And so he went to this bar and thought he would, you know, be able to rub shoulders with some of Hartford's elite. And we were dispersed somewhat throughout the bar. There was probably about 15 of us in there. We had a Dick Cheney, complete with a mask. We had a William F. Buckley, which was myself, wearing a suit and a wig, armed with stacks and stacks of these Buckley bucks. And we just camped it out, waited for Joe Lieberman to come in. He managed to move a little bit through the restaurant until we broke out in song, started singing a very polemical song about Joe Lieberman being William F. Buckley's whore. And William F. Buckley, myself, was there tossing these Buckley bucks in the air. Joe Lieberman was planning on staying a while and really, you know, getting to know his constituents, et cetera, in a pretty slimy campaign move. Instead, the guy lasted maybe 10, 15 minutes in this bar before he really had to leave. There was an attempt to drown out our singing with some rather impotent and vocally harsh chanting by his supporters. But as the Hartford Current put it, they were no match for these well-trained men and women. And we made a real scene, and you know, we made it so that this guy was incredibly polarized and realized that our political presence there is prohibiting him from really being able to do the campaigning that he thought he was going to be able to do, which was sit down with his main support base, not get challenged, smile for the camera, shake a bunch of hands, and be on his merry way, without ever being confronted and challenged with the fact that he has all of these connections with right-wing, insane individuals that are on the same line for Bush's no-exit war and are in the same direction for total chaos and essentially the destruction of the United States. So this guy is definitely being challenged. Yesterday, he had three similar events, the last of which was in a Spanish market, which was run by a guy who has supposedly, through rumors, we'd have to look into this further, connections with the same Cuban mafia that was funding Lieberman's campaign back in 1988. And so we went to this place, and he was doing a similar thing inside the market, trying to reach out to the lower 80%. And we just started singing to him, opened up for song, throwing the Buckley bucks around. We had another chorus outside. The three people inside I guess after a head nod from the head honcho of this Spanish market or Cuban market, they got escorted out by the police and arrested. And the chorus outside continued to sing, polarized the entire environment. Joe Lieberman was just really, really destabilized. The whole time he was trying to campaign and trying to organize the population while being drowned out by our music. So we're really trying to make it difficult for this guy.
Well, Miles, if you can stay on for a few more minutes, I want to come back to you. If people want to see the coverage of the Hartford Courant, which is a very interesting coverage, in today's paper at courant.com, and it's courant.com, you'll see their discussion of singing hecklers harassing him in harmony. Obviously, this Elizabeth Hamilton, who's written the articles, is quite taken by your singing up there. So we'll get back to Miles in a moment. I want to bring up, before I get to Nico in the nerve center of the war room, we have two emails, one from Robert Hill in San Luis Obispo, California, and another one from James R. Calvert, pointing to what may be the last bastion of hope for Rove, Bush, and Cheney, and that is electronic voting machines, the Diebold fraud. There was a movie, a kind quasi-documentary on HBO the other night. I think it was called Hacking Elections or something like that. But it was a factual presentation of what most people already know, which is that the voting machines can be rigged. Lyndon LaRouche is on record as calling for the necessity for minimally a paper trail so that there are papers that are available to back up what shows up on the computers. But more than that, we've got to get rid of these machines. You cannot have a company that has financial ties to the existing regime running the voting machines. Now, at this point, the main thing people can do is make sure that we get a huge landslide on Tuesday so that if fraud is pulled, it becomes so painfully obvious that even the wimpy Democrats will go in and fight to get the vote counted. And it's a federal offense, it's a felony to mess around with the votes. But ultimately what we're going to have to do is take back the Congress and get legislation on this. But in the short term, main thing people can do is mobilize your neighbors, mobilize your family, people at church, friends. Get them out to vote on Tuesday. Let's get a Democratic landslide, and then we'll sort things out after that. And what I mean by that is November 16th, Lyndon LaRouche will be doing his next webcast. It will be, I believe, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It will be a discussion of recovering from the crash of 2007. And before the end of the show, I'll bring that up again, but put that on your calendar, November 16th, the next webcast from Lyndon LaRouche. Now, let's turn to Nico Paulson, who is now in the war room. Nico, you've been hearing the reports we've had from Missouri, from the East Coast in Connecticut, from the West Coast in Los Angeles. You've been sitting there getting these reports in, firing back out to the regions. What's your assessment of the overall state of mobilization of the LaRouche Youth Movement?
Well, what I would say is most significant from what I've seen of the national deployment so far is that the way that we've been organizing, we're actually doing and saying the things that other people only would have dreamed of. They really would like to do it, and they're very enthusiastic about the fact that we're coming out there and we're saying and doing these things and opposing operations which, under different circumstances, you know, no one in their right mind would actually tolerate. And in a sense, we've become a champion on campuses and, in Connecticut, in campaigns for people who are actually serious about telling the truth. And it's had a very catalytic effect on media, on students, on the population generally around them. And the really funny thing about it is that we're attacking these fascists in the one way that they're completely unprepared for, and that's absolutely intolerable in their view. I mean, the funny thing is someone like Yaron Brook, who's claims to be an objectivist philosopher, or anyone else from the ARI, or someone such as David Horowitz, or even Joe Lieberman, you know, these people are willing to debate the issues, you know, in a very formal way, but we haven't really done that. What we've done is we've gone in with irony, with humor, and we've simply mocked them because their arguments aren't legitimate. These people are not autonomous. They're being deployed in their tools of a top-down push for war, and we're simply mocking them for what they are, having a fantastic time, and actually getting the population to look at just how ridiculous these people really are. And they're completely freaking out about it. And the thing is, it's infectious. What you pointed out a moment ago about the Hartford Courant's coverage of what we did in singing on these interventions, it was hilarious, and they thought it was hilarious too, right? And they're getting behind our activity. It's far more interesting than anything that Joseph Lieberman or Ned Lamont is saying. Likewise, what's going on at UCLA and USC and these various different campuses in California, where we've had these interventions against the Ayn Rand Institute and some of their speakers there, you know, the student body is sort of eating this stuff up. It's hilarious, and it's actually getting them to think and you know, regardless of whether people agree entirely with what we're doing or not, when people think, that's really a victory for us because we're telling the truth. And if we can actually get people's minds working, which we've been doing quite effectively, this really pays off for the forces of reason in the long term. And I think that's evident by the fact that our enemies are really terrified at this point in time, which you brought up a moment ago about Lynn Cheney being brought on Wolf Blitzer to do damage control and then just getting pushed further into a corner. It's a perfect example. Or the fact that Joseph Lieberman has now, one, he canceled all further public debates. And if you check out his website, he's actually taken down off the website any of the public speaking engagements. You can't find them on his website because he's terrified that people are going to come to his events and they're going to and they're going to make a fool of him just like we have. So I think it's a pretty clear indication by how much our enemies are terrified of us at this point in time of the effectiveness that we've really had so far. And you know, likewise, you're seeing a real spurt of growth in terms of recruitment from campuses. For instance, in Washington, D.C., we just recruited a kid out of this whole campaign. And, you know, similar things are going on various other places across the country. So I think that it's, you know, a good example being Missouri as well. There are young people there who, after having, you know, only known us for about 10 days, are expressing interest in, you know, going out and organizing in Los Angeles with us full time. It's a perfect example of the fact that you've got a population that's looking to fight. They know there's something wrong. They might not know everything about it, but they want to do something about it. Unfortunately, that wasn't put on the syllabus, and we're actually giving them an opportunity.
I guess if people want to know where Joe Lieberman is going to be today, you should probably call William F. Buckley and ask him where to find Weeping Joe. Now, Nico, in giving this sort of broad overview, you made the point of the role of irony and humor, and I would encourage people to, as soon as we get the new webcast, the October 31st webcast, we're going to have, I presume, a DVD and a pamphlet, and our listeners should call in to the 800-929-7566 number and pre-order that, because in it, there's a whole section where Lyndon LaRouche talks about the question of sophistry and how we are a culture of sophistry, and it was sophistry, that is, the commitment to lying, the rejection of the idea that there's a truth, which was the downfall of ancient Greece. And up to this point, in the person of the baby boomer generation, which is a sophistical generation, we're seeing the same thing collapse the United States through people like Lieberman. Now, Nico, you've been a member of the LIM for a while. You've been out in Seattle. You've been in D.C. for quite a while. Are you more optimistic now that humor and irony expressing deeper truths is an effective way to attack the sophistry in the society?
Absolutely. I really think that it's been demonstrated simply in what we've done that it's actually the only effective mode of intervening into these circles, because the last thing that you're going to want to do, because it falls right into the sophist trap, is try and get into a point-for-point debate with one of these people, because they've thought through the argument that they're making to a certain extent, and that, you know, they're willing to sort of maneuver on those terms. But when you start attacking the premises and actually comparing the premises of their argument with what's actually true, the absurdity of it all really comes out to the forefront, and that's, you know, that's exactly what we've done in singing these songs, you know, with employing drama, what Miles did in Connecticut with the, you know, the William F. Buckley impersonation, these Buckley Bucks. It's hilarious. And the same thing with these Ayn Rand interventions. You know, it makes a complete mockery of objectivist philosophy, which that's the one thing, not taking it seriously, simply looking at it as something which is really absurd, which in fact it is the one thing that these guys just can't tolerate. I think it's really the only way that you're going to effectively be able to combat these people whose arguments just aren't based on reality. They might be logically consistent, but they're not consistent with what's true. And that's what needs to be really brought to people's attention and made fun of.
Well, I'm going to be doing a class tonight in Los Angeles, which is on why even Don Giovanni wouldn't go to bed with Ayn Rand. Miles, I know we're down in the home stretch up there. The problem I see with Connecticut and is that the Lamont campaign has been unwilling to do what we're doing. Have you been disappointed by what you've seen so far from Lamont's campaign?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a glaring truth that this guy is not really doing that much. And it's funny because people come up to us at these interventions. They see the kind of energy that we have. And you know, it's all directed into getting Lieberman out. And they say, are you guys openly supporting Lamont? And, you know, our response is, you know, saying, well, no, we're not openly supporting oatmeal for the United States Senate. But like oatmeal, it does fill a gap. And what I've been somewhat focusing on is when getting people who are, you know, trying to get me to endorse Lamont or something, I say, look, you know, the guy obviously is not doing anything proactive about mobilizing the youth vote, about putting forward a constructive policy for redeployment in Iraq, et cetera. I mean, any real policy that Lyndon LaRouche is talking about that goes over a proactive approach to actually dealing with a problem, Lamont is avoiding like the plague. And so, you know, we're just trying to make sure that people realize that this guy would, if an impeachment came up in the Senate, vote for the impeachment of Cheney and Bush. I mean, that much he has been explicit about, his disapproval with this administration. So like I said, we're not openly endorsing Ned Lamont, but the fact is that this guy is not tied in with the William F. Buckley circles. He's not tied in with the Lynn Cheney circles. And, you know, if that's the only virtue that you've got going for you, I think it's indicative of somewhat of a vacuum of real leadership. And Connecticut is besides the political activity that we have going here, is somewhat dead. Ned Lamont is gearing up in the next few days. We're going to go to some of his events and just see what his supporters think, try to get them mobilized in helping us crush Lieberman. But other than that, I mean, there's really not that much going on.
Well, let me ask you this, because we make fun at times of Harvard and Yale, and you're of course very familiar with organizing at Harvard. Between the two of them, which university is turning out better sophists, Harvard or Yale?
Well, it's funny. I mean, at Harvard, at least people stay up on what's going on. And it's difficult to compare the two because the curriculums are essentially the same. But at Harvard, people want to talk. People want to really get political. At Yale, we're finding people are just so consumed with busy work, and they're in this little haven in Connecticut. It's called New Havens. It's kind of funny. But they're somewhat tucked away from political reality. And, you know, I've actually had pretty extensive discussions. They turned out rather extensive with people who actually did not know that this was an election year, did not know that Connecticut was one of the key states in determining whether we get out of the war or not. And so it's somewhat shocking, but with these Ivy League institutions, you really gotta treat them like experiment grounds and kind of go up and poke them the right way. You find people who are very bright and who are very critical of what's going on and have the ability of actually questioning some of the stuff that they think.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in that respect, I think that both are somewhat similar.
Well, let me give our listeners a very quick survey of the what can happen Tuesday, because Connecticut has, in addition to the Lieberman-Lamont race, you have three Republican congressional seats, which are very much within the grasp of the Democratic Party winning. Pennsylvania, there are five or six seats held by Republicans, including the senator, Santorum, who's a very bad guy, who faces a crushing defeat. But also there are four or five other congressional races that can be won by the Democrats. In Ohio, there are four or five races up for grabs. It's likely that the Democrats can win the Senate seat there. But it looks like Virginia, the Webb Allen campaign, Tennessee, where Harold Ford is running against Corker, and Missouri, where we heard from Ardina before, where Claire McCaskill is running against Talent, a no-talent neocon tied to Santorum. There's an opportunity to sweep the country, to knock the Republican majorities out in the same way that the so-called Gingrich Revolution knocked out the Democratic lead control of the House and Senate in 1994. Now, Nico, from your standpoint, obviously you've been watching how the campus organizing is affecting this. After the election, it's clear with the webcast on the 16th, we've got a lot of work to do, but we should be bringing all these on all these campuses, showings of the webcast, bringing people into D.C. What are we planning for the period between this weekend and the webcast on November 16th?
Well, I think that at this point, we've actually got close to 500,000 copies of the Is Joseph Goebbels on Your Campus pamphlet that have already they're already in circulation, and there are about 750,000 that have been printed. So even after November 7th, that's still going to be incredibly relevant. And I think one of the things that was striking to me when LaRouche created the national deployment that we're currently involved in right now is that it's not an election campaign per se, although it's very much related to the election, and it's not a single issue campaign. One of the things that that the Democratic Party had done is they took a case by case approach to dealing with the congressional elections. That is, they looked at what they deemed to be close races, and they simply put all of their attention and efforts into that, putting money behind those candidates alone. And there wasn't
and
really.
They also, Nico, they also looked in those districts, and if they were southern districts, they said, we need a conservative Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going, as LaRouche said, after the big issue in the campaign, namely Bush and Cheney, they've run mealy-mouthed campaigns all over the country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what LaRouche organized was something entirely different. He said, we need a strategy that's actually going to be much more broad-based. We're actually going to take the youth population and actually involve them directly into the political process, which is something that's been neglected by both political parties for a very long time. And in a sense, that's what we're working on right now. That's what this campaign drive that we're pushing is. It's actually to reactivate the 18 to 30-year-old population in the United States to get these people's minds working and give them a fighting sense that there's actually something that they, in fact, can do. So we're going to continue pushing on campuses throughout the country. And I know that already we're working on setting up forums for the next webcast in November on these various campuses. And, you know, the funny thing is, when I was organizing on George Washington University in Georgetown, these various different schools in Washington, D.C., you know, these kids all know that they're being brainwashed. They all know all of these operations are being run against them. But up until now, what else is on the table for them? They say, "Well, you just have to be practical. Yeah, I have to go through this process. There's, you know, I may not like it, but there's not really another option on the table." And what we're doing is we're actually giving them another option. We're fighting against the forces that are actually keeping these people down. And we're inspiring them to take action in a similar way and giving them, you know, the one thing that we can give them, because we can't give them money, we can't give them anything like that, but we can give them intellectual freedom.
So, Nico, I assume after the election, the war room stays open.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, Miles Robinson from Connecticut, Nico Paulson from the War Room, thanks for joining us. There will be another webcast November 16th where Lyndon LaRouche will be discussing the strategy to get out of the crash of 2007. It's something that cannot be missed by anyone who considers themselves a citizen on the planet. And if you want information on this, you want to set up a satellite webcast session, call us at 7566. So again, my thanks to the panelists. I think we've given people something to think about. Also, you can call that number to get the pamphlet. Let's use this election to change the history of the world. This has been the LaRouche Show. Thanks for joining us.